Poet Philip Levine died Saturday at the age of 87, and today we're remembering his beginnings in Detroit, where he held a series of blue-collar jobs and then wrote poetry about the working class that produced him, winning a Pulitzer and the title of Poet Laureate in 2011. We spoke then and began by asking him to read an excerpt from his poem, What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line, waiting at Fort Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting. Shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course, it's someone else's brother. Narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants.
Poet Laureate Philip Levine, who's been called the working man's poet, an urban poet. Let's learn a little bit more about why these characters resonated for you in real life. Born in Detroit in 1928, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants. You went to college and then, as we said, went to work at Cadillac, Chevrolet. What else did you hear and see in those factories that called up poetry for you?
I would say, you know, in the early years when I was writing and working, I wrote nothing about the factory. Nothing. I'd come home and I usually worked nights, so I'd sleep, then I'd get up, and I'd have a lot of daytime light to work in to do what I wanted. But I was writing all kinds of poems, but I was not writing that. A doctor wouldn't write poems about his patients. I mean, he'd say, "Oh God, that's shop. What the hell do I want to do that for?" I mean, you look at William Carlos Williams' poetry. You know, most of his life he was a doctor. And there are not that many poems about doctoring.
Yeah.
I mean, I have many more poems about that life. But the irony is, of course, that I left that life at age 26 and then shifted slowly into academia, which left me a lot more time for writing.
Is it poetry or almost a form of journalism? In the LA Times wrote, it's sort of the poetry of this is who I am and this is what happened to me. I'm looking at one, A Woman Waking.
Yeah.
It's a story about a woman remembering her father who used to light the stove and then measure the coffee, and then he would come and shake her awake, smelling of gasoline and whispering, then he left. That idea of telling a story, having me picture
no.
that? No.
No, that's not what it's about for everybody. It happens to be about that for me, but not only just that. We bring our own lives to poetry, and that's part of my life. And, you know, when I was about, 19 or 20, at the time I was working at Detroit Transmission, I remember. And one day I'm walking out with a buddy I met on the line. He knows I write poetry. And I said to him, I made up this little story. Little did that inconspicuous assembly worker realize that someday he would place this magic into poetry that the world would love. I made up this BS, you know. And the guy said, "Are you serious about that, Phil?" And I thought for a second and I said, "Yeah, it may not work out. I may not do it, but it's what I want to do." And here were these people. They were very different from me, many of them very different. But they extended themselves to me. They embraced me, sometimes physically, more often emotionally, mentally, what have you. And I embraced them. And I remember a line from Whitman, "There is that lot of me, all so luscious." And I remember when I read that, and I said, "Could that be true about me?" And I thought, why the hell not? And as I began to see myself in those terms, I began to see these people in those terms with their stories. And, you know, I mean, you look at the history of English poetry. Are there stories in Keats? Yes. Are there stories in Shelley? Yes. In Byron? Yes. In Shakespeare? God, yes. Some of my favorite poems are have stories. Some of them don't. Robert Frost is a fantastic storyteller. Why give up stories? At one time, that's what poetry was about. When Homer wrote his poems, it was about stories.
If you've just joined us, we're hearing again from Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Levine, who died Saturday at the age of 87. He came to be known as the working man's poet for highlighting the struggles of blue-collar life. In 2011, we asked him if he thought fine art like poetry could alleviate those struggles.
I remember my brother saw a particular movie and told me to go see it. And I went to see it, and I didn't think much of it. And he called me, and what'd you think of it, Phil? And I said, I walked out on it. Why? I said, the movie theater was so cold, and I didn't wear a jacket. And this movie was not good enough to let me forget that I was freezing. And he said, he had a friend, the wonderful artist, Bob Thompson. He said, Bob Thompson said to me, great art will always transport you. It will always focus you. I said, first thing, it was a mediocre movie. Second thing, that's nonsense. You're sitting there with a toothache and you're going to be transfixed by great art. Get out of here.
So if you can't comfort the jobless, I mean, what do you think you can do as a poet laureate?
Well, I think one thing that poetry does, although most of us who write poetry probably don't sit down to intend to do this, and you could say this for literature, not just poetry, that people read it and they find out that other people, these authors or the body of characters in the book, who seem so radically different from them, are intensely human people, and they suffer as much as they suffer. The way The Grapes of Wrath would let you know? Mm-hmm. It's not a great novel, I don't think, because Steinbeck isn't much of a writer. Mm-hmm. But it's a great story. And the characters are vivid. And you read the book and you say, oh, my God, how can we let our country do this to these people? And I would think the same thing could happen today. People would read the right books. They would say, you know, they're actually human beings living in Cuba. Think of it. They're like us. They want to give things to their kids. They want their kids to be healthy. I mean, this can so enrich you and remind you of what it means to be human when you're truly human. Poetry's done that for me.
And Philip Levine, so that idea that you had as an assembly worker, that worked out pretty well, as it turns out.
Yeah, it was a long process, you know. I mean, when I said I was 20, so it said 63 years ago. Yeah. But, you know, one of the great things about poetry is that it's not an easy undertaking. You give your life to it, and it's a worthy enterprise for a life. That's how it has struck me. And poetry has been incredibly generous to me. So many of my good friends I've met through poetry, partly from teaching and becoming friends with some of my students, but also reading people of my generation who wrote me and I wrote them, and we met and we became dear friends, and they've enriched my life enormously. So I owe an enormous amount to poetry, and I can never really repay it, but I can do my best.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine speaking with us in 2011. He died Saturday at the age of 87, and we'll give him the last word. Here he is reading from his poem, Our Valley.
We don't see the ocean, not ever. But in July and August, when the worst heat seems to rise from the hard clay of this valley, you could be walking through a fig orchard when suddenly the wind cools and for a moment you get a whiff of salt. And in that moment, you can almost believe something is waiting beyond the Pacheco Pass. Something massive, irrational, and so powerful, even the mountains that rise east of here have no word for it. You probably think I'm nuts, saying the mountains have no word for ocean. But if you live here, You begin to believe they know everything. They maintain that huge silence we think of as divine, a silence that grows in autumn when snow falls slowly between the pines and the wind dies to less than a whisper. And you can barely catch your breath because you're thrilled and terrified. You have to remember this isn't your land. It belongs to no one, like the sea you once lived beside and thought was yours. Remember the small boats that bobbed out as the waves rode in, and the men who carved a living from it only to find themselves carved down to nothing. Now you say, this is home. So go ahead, worship the mountains as they dissolve in dust. Wait on the wind. Catch a scent of salt. Call it our life.
And you're listening to Here and Now